for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Mid-Atlantic continues to dig out from huge snowstorms. The Fed hints at an interest rate hike. Toyota and Honda expand recalls. And former President Bill Clinton is released from the hospital after undergoing a heart procedure. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, Ron Elving of NPR, Christopher Rowland of the Boston Globe, and Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times and PoliticsDaily.com. It's good to have you all here. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Despite the snow we've been dealing with, I'm glad you all got here, and I look forward to hearing from the rest of you around the country, around the world. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Ron Elving, let's start with the details on this jobs bill that we've just heard Senator Harry Reid say he's going to move forward on. Republicans don't seem happy, neither do some Democrats.
That's the case, and it's frequently the case, that people are unhappy on both sides. Harry Reid's trying to find the elements of this jobs bill that are probably fastest to pass. And so first they had a rather large bipartisan compromise that had a lot of features to it, and then he pared it down to just four things. Some of these are a little bit technical, but there's a payroll tax holiday on that Social Security tax to try to encourage businesses to hire more people.
For how long?
That's only for a matter of months. So
okay.
It's not going to make an enormous difference, but it's supposed to be a quick trigger. Only a quick trigger to get people to hire people right away. There's also a write down for equipment that businesses buy that's supposed to encourage them to have more money to hire people to work on that equipment. There's a $2 billion subsidy for public works bonds to try to get people to buy these and encourage public works projects. And there's an extension of the Highway Trust Fund. All of these things are pretty generally agreed to be passable in the short term. And then, of course, they are supposed to be the things that would jumpstart a little bit of job creation as quickly as possible.
But, Christopher Rowland, was this truly a bipartisan effort or not?
Well, it does seem that there were some bipartisan elements to it, and if they can get a compromise, it'll definitely be good news, I think, for the Democrats and the Republicans, too, who are taking their hits for being seen as obstinate. I think the key thing, though, is it's not really going to create that many jobs. I think it has a much more powerful value as a political symbol as, okay, we are going to work together, America, and we are going to start moving forward.
Because both sides are feeling the heat.
There's been polling that shows that that both Republicans and Democrats are equally the targets of voter ire right now.
So, Lynn Sweet, where does it go from here?
Well, the goal is to have something passed. That's why this original jobs package, which was supposed to be one mega bill, was broken down. Harry Reid, the Senate leader, needs to have some victories. He has a tough reelection fight in Nevada that's coming up in November. And the reason while you could dispute the tactics policy-wise, if it's better to break it down, the chances of some of these four elements passing are much better broken down, even though some of the Republicans did complain that, they had this whole interconnected package. So what happens next is they're going to start voting on these different elements. And I think that you will end up with some bipartisan roll calls because jobs is an issue that crosses party lines.
Crosses party lines big time, Ron.
Nobody wants to be against jobs, not right now. Jobs is the great focus of American politics for the next 6 months to 12 months at least. So that's why I think Harry Reid pared away a lot of these other things. While they did have a fair degree of support on one side of the aisle or the other, research and development tax credits, extending unemployment benefits, some health care stuff, he pared all that away because some of it smacked of the kind of smaller scale deal-making that got the health care bill such a bad bruise as a public policy image back in December.
Now, we've got this new Washington Post ABC poll, Chris Rowland, reporting that two-thirds of Americans are dissatisfied or, quote, downright angry about the way the federal government is working, with good reason.
I think so. I think that, I think that they see, despite various protestations towards bipartisanship on both sides, I think a lot of the tactical maneuvering is seen as, you know, politics as usual, partisanship as usual. And Washington doesn't seem to be moving right now in a direction that's going to be solving America's number one problem, which is the economy. You know, the unemployment rates are still, you know, 10% or slightly below. The people are angry, they're fed up, and they just don't see that Washington is working for them right now.
And, of course, Washington's been shut down all week, Lynn, because of this incredible snowstorm. Now Congress is on recess until after President's Day. I mean, the country must be looking at this city where, I must say, I have not received a single piece of mail since last Saturday. The government has shut down.
Well, Washington is not a good city for snow. I mean, I come from Chicago, so I'm and my colleague here is from Boston. Ron, I don't know where you're from.
Originally but, Chicago.
Okay. All right. I should have remembered that. So, you know, snow does not shut down the cities that we grew up in. This is, even by Chicago or Boston standards, this is extraordinary. But as a metaphor, this works very powerfully and symbolically of a city that can't even fight snow effectively. Though, again, this is an unprecedented snowstorm. And, oh, my God, I hope my roof doesn't collapse. But the point that you make is one that I think is going to resonate throughout the country, because all they know is that there's still talk on health care when people thought, why are we going to try and re-trigger that fight? I know we might get to that. One of the interesting things, by the way, about the jobs bill and the Washington gridlock is that there had been some feeling of why not try some programs of direct employment. Everything that was just talked about in these four pillars are dealing with tax policy or tax breaks or bonding that goes through a, you know, municipal government that have to have shovel-ready projects. That sounds a lot like the big stimulus bill that Obama passed last year that still hasn't had all that money spent. You know, and that becomes a side issue of its own. So in terms of triggering employment right away, you have to say that since no one is predicting that we'll get, you know, below this 9-10% that we're at, you wonder how fast even these programs can kick in.
Chris.
I think that getting back to the poll is that, I think that the warning sign is for that is that there's a number of polls that now show that for the Republicans that they are in the, coming into the midterms, they should not feel too cocky, I think. I think that the widespread anger focused at both parties signals that it's in their best interest to compromise and try to work with the Democrats as well.
Don't you have to wonder, Diane, who are the 25-30% of the people who are happy with Washington? I mean, if they seriously are giving that answer, because I can't imagine anyone given the choice between President Obama's his administration, the Democrat and their leadership, the Democratic leadership in Congress, and then the Republicans in Congress. If you can be mad at any one of those three, how could you miss? How could you not be mad at one of those three, if not at all three?
Well, I think it's also frustration, because even if you don't want to get into the blame game, I think I've said this here before, if your house price still is tanked, if you're unemployed or underemployed, you have a problem that transcends political parties.
I mean, you also had these 60-plus nominees from the White House who were being stalled by one senator, Ron.
Yes, that's right. Dick Shelby from Alabama was angry about a couple of things that affected Alabama. They also affect national security, a couple of contracts, one for a plane that's a tanker and another for some analysis of bomb materials. But they were going to be Alabama contracts, and they hadn't gotten they hadn't gotten into the spending bills. They hadn't gotten funded. So talking about the national security element of it, he suddenly says, I'm putting a hold on all nominees pending. And at the time, I believe there were about 70. Then it came down to 63. And the president actually confronted the Republican Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, about this at the White House on Tuesday and said, Mitch, you know, I've been a senator. I've seen this in bad times and good. And this is really pushing the envelope to say, I'm going to block every nominee without respect to the merits of those nominees, just because I need a couple of things for my home state. Where's that going to lead?
So the president now says he's encouraged by the 27 who've been approved, Lynn?
Well, having those hostages released doesn't necessarily get the point made, but at least it breaks some gridlock. What it does highlight for the public, I'm guessing, is that some of these Senate rules just make no sense to people. Why do you need a supermajority to get work done in the Senate nowadays? Why can one senator block a confirmation? At least we know who had the hold, by the way. Usually this is secret.
Do you really believe there's going to be a kind of massive review of those Senate rules to really think about do they make sense or not?
Well, for the moment, maybe, because the Democrats lost the supermajority that they had been relying on to sail their legislation through. So since they have, for the time being, a comfortable majority, maybe they will be more open to reviewing the rules, at least until November.
I don't think that they will be really reviewing it aggressively. I feel like that's sort of, remember the so-called nuclear option when the Republicans thought about getting rid of the filibuster rule. And that was at a time of extreme partisanship. And I think that it didn't happen that time. And I don't expect it'll happen this time. I mean, there's too much at stake for the Republicans. There's no reason for them to come to the table on this. They have a lot of leverage. Plus now they have Scott Brown, the 41st vote. And there's no reason for them to deal.
I think we should remember that these Senate rules are made by senators for senators, for the benefit and the privilege of the senators. This is not from the Constitution. This is not from anyone other than the individual members of the Senate back over the generations who have built up these rules, including a rule saying you can't change the rules with anything less than a two-thirds vote, almost impossible to imagine. And these are all there to protect the rights of individual senators and minorities within the Senate. And, of course, for many, many years, they were primarily for the benefit of keeping civil rights bills from passing. And the Southern senators blocked all that using these rules.
Ron Elving, he's Washington editor for National Public Radio. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the domestic portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Christopher Rowland, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist at politicsdaily.com, and Ron Elving. He's Washington editor for National Public Radio. Do join us 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Bill asking a reasonable question. He says, when children miss school due to snow, they make it up over the holidays. I find it absurd Congress can't do the same, that they would take a holiday this coming Monday and not use that day as an opportunity to make up for the work they've missed only highlights the lack of perspective members of Congress possess. Ron Elming.
It's hard to defend the way Congress does its calendar, and it's very hard to defend the way they've done their schedule. But traditionally, they don't spend that much time in Washington in January and February. They try to spend that time either in their districts or visiting parts of the world where they are gathering information. And some of that has some value. But traditionally, they take a couple of recesses. They don't spend that much time in here in January and then again in February. And really, there are a fair number of people in the country who would probably be just as happy if this Congress stayed home for some extended period of time.
Here's another email from David, who says, why is the Patriot Act included in the jobs bill, Ron?
Well, there were quite a number of things thrown into the soup when they were putting together this this bipartisan bill. And one of the things that does not seem at all related to jobs was a Medicare fix for doctors' payments. And there are a number of different things that were thrown in. One of them was an extension of the Patriot Act. And this was obviously meant to get a certain number of votes on the Republican side of the aisle. And some of the Democrats objected to it. And finally, Harry Reid threw his hands up and said, I'm getting so many objections to some of these smaller, more extraneous things, or not in all cases, is small but extraneous things, that I'm just going to pare this down to the four things I think I can jam through.
Chris.
I think that was smart. I think that stripping it down was the right thing to do, and I think that that will give them a chance to make some progress. And on the point about going home to their districts, it's one of those things that cuts both ways, where collectively people get angry at Congress because they're not really doing anything.
But your
guy, if he's home during that holiday and he's in your district, then you like him.
All right. And speaking of the unhappiness we were talking about before the break, Sarah Palin was the featured speaker in the first National Tea Party Convention last weekend, tapping into, Lynn Sweet, some say, that mood of frustration.
Well, yes, but the question is, how widespread is it? Who really knows about the Tea Party? I thought there was an interesting Washington Post ABC News poll that was taken earlier in the month that says only nearly two-thirds of Americans don't really know what the party stands for. It's kind of amorphous right now. It's not intending to become a third party or any kind of permanent political organization that's going to run candidates or start the ballot process that you need to become a real organization. So I think the movement for right now could just morph into a vehicle for Sarah Palin herself more than anything else.
And yet the polls on Sarah Palin don't reflect too well, Chris.
No, I think it's interesting to note that, Sarah Palin is certainly leaving the door open for a presidential run. Her numbers are worse than Obama's right now. And I think that she has, significant problems in her own, how she's going to make up ground. I still think she may be suffering a little bit from resigning as Alaska governor to basically, launch a massive media campaign on Fox TV and writing books and, spending time in the lower 48 instead of, sort of leaving her post, if you will.
Well, no, I think that the Tea Party represents for her a base, political base. She doesn't have a geographic base in the way that some people do who when they start running for president. And even though it's kind of amorphous, it gives her a place to go. It gives her a movement to be a part of. And I don't think the two are striking each other out, her own ratings as well as where the Tea Party goes, because that can be a tether for her that is not related to a paid television gig or selling her book.
What do you think, Ron?
My sense is that she is embodying to a certain degree and giving voice to a very generalized sense of unhappiness with government in general, the size of government, the levels of taxation, the apparent ineffectiveness of government at making anyone's life better. All these are perceptions, are all arguable conclusions, but clearly, there is a large number of people, whatever it exactly is in the country, 25, 30, 35% of the country, that feels a generalized rejection of government, particularly the federal government. And she has become, in a sense, their natural spokesperson. Mm-hmm. She is enormously mediagenic. She is perhaps fingernails on a blackboard for a lot of people. But even that makes her an effective spokesperson for this very generalized unhappiness.
And to try to address some of that assessment on the part of the American public that Washington is not working, President Obama has issued an invitation to congressional Democrats and Republicans for a summit meeting on health care on February 25th. What are the expectations, Chris?
Well, I think both sides would like to be able to say that they're going into this with an open mind and that they are going to try to show the American people where they stand on health care, and that could be a really freewheeling dialogue that could result in some progress on health care. I think maybe the that may not be necessarily the outcome. I have a feeling that they're both going to be going in with their talking points and looking to score points that are with the American people, and that they're both really dug in and that not a whole lot is going to come out of it.
Some people are saying, and especially Republicans, that the whole health care bill so far should simply be scrapped. At which point didn't President Obama say, okay, you want to start at ground zero, let's do it?
I don't think President Obama is interested in starting back at ground zero. I think he might be interested in explaining to people what about the current bill they don't want to throw out with the bathwater. And I don't think that the president wants to yield to any of the other demands that the Republicans were making as a kind of price to come to the summit.
What kind of price?
Well, for example, they wanted the Democrats to take off the table the option of using the reconciliation process to pass some kind of health care bill. We've talked about the filibuster. We've talked about the 60-vote requirement. There are some alternative paths. One of them has to do with the budgeting, and it is called reconciliation. It's pretty abstruse. Most people are never going to understand it, and most of us are never going to admit how little we really understand it. But it is possible to pass with 51 votes in the Senate, or possibly even 50 votes plus Joe Biden, something that could carry much of the health care bill forward into the next year. Now, it wouldn't be permanent in the same way that a statutory adoption would be, but it would be a way for the Democrats to declare victory on the health care front.
Right, but that's an option, Ron, they always had, and they chose not to do it because they thought it would be very politically unpopular. So I suppose part of what you're going to see in this February 25th meeting is a TV show, because Obama got beat up for not being transparent, as he had promised in the negotiations. The Republican challenge is not to look like the audience, but to look like an equal partner, which is very hard. When the Republican town hall meeting took place recently, it was clear that Obama was the host and taking questions from the audience. Now, you can't play Oprah on this kind of meeting and expect to come out of it a bipartisan result. On the other hand, the Republicans have to figure out, do they want to come out or come up with something that the public can buy into and the White House could buy into so they could claim victory?
I think Obama's going to be trying to paint the Republicans as obstinate and obstructive, and that's really going to be the challenge for
that's
the Republicans.
That's the change, isn't it, on the part of the president? To paint Republicans in that way.
I think that's really the best alternative right now is to fight fire with fire.
Yeah.
And the Republicans, for their part in this meeting, are going to be trying to show that this big Democratic proposal is a massive government program and that it's going to be bad for the American people.
But see, we've heard that song before. I don't think they could go in there and just say the problem really is medical malpractice and you have to do tort reform. That just... You hear that a lot, and you need something in there, I think, that shows that people are going to try to move. One of the things that will be interesting is to see whether or not the Obama White House keeps changing the definition of bipartisanship. It had been for many months. Bipartisanship is just incorporating the ideas of Republicans in some of our bills. It doesn't matter if we have a roll call. Remember, no major Obama legislation passed last year in the House with any Republican votes. So they need to understand, I think, that bipartisanship is not just incorporating some ideas, but getting more of a buy-in to get something passed.
If the Senate operated on the House's rules, on simple majority rule, I doubt we'd be hearing very much about bipartisanship.
You know,
59 is plenty.
Well, you would have had a bill by now.
and you certainly would have.
And speaking of those 60 votes that you have to have, didn't the Tea Party goers make some mistake on that?
There was some talk in Nashville about how the 60 votes had some root in the Constitution. Some of the people who attended some of the different meetings there were asking if that weren't the case, and reporters were asking people, well, where do you think the 60 votes comes from? And some of them were saying, well, isn't it in the Constitution? And I do think that there is a generalized sense that the way that the Senate operates has more root in the actual founding fathers' thinking than it actually does. A lot of the Senate rules were written in just the last, say, century, century and a quarter, and not changed very often. And they are, originally it was two-thirds to have cloture and stop a filibuster. They did lower that to 60. They could do it again if they could get 67.
Though, you know, our founding fathers.
I think in the last decade or so, also, the senators have been much more willing to go and use the filibuster to block initiatives. I think it was used more rarely in the past as
That's
well.
The great unintended consequence of lowering the cloture vote from 67 to just 60 was that at that point, senators felt like, hey, I could use this for a contract back in my home state. I could use this for a particular issue in the budget that I want to care about, whereas before it had been a nuclear weapon, only one issue, and even then you had to have it be totally existential to you.
The idea of this all is not as totally as recent. Our founding fathers in the Federalist Papers did write about the tyranny of the majority.
That concept was certainly part of the original thinking, but the idea that there were specified numbers of votes, I mean, there were only 26 senators in the original Senate, so the idea that 60 votes was some sort of sacred number is certainly not true.
I think a lot of what all this does come around to in the current context, though, is the leadership of in the Democratic majority and whether they are going to be willing to do reconciliation or to use the power of their majority to get stuff through ultimately. They're going to have to be, I think, from Democrats' perspective, they're going to have to be tougher.
Christopher Rowland of the Boston Globe, Ron Elving of NPR, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones in just a few minutes. First, I want to get a sense from you, before we leave the snow, how much this is going to cost the federal and state governments. Lynn.
The cost on local governments is going to be the highest and the fastest because they have to pay overtime for plows, for equipment on that. If you talk about, there's some talk of having this declared a national emergency, and then if these areas that are hard hit get aid, that doesn't dent a budget, a federal budget, in the way that these local city budgets and suburban budgets are going to get hit by having the snowfall. Economists then will look at the economic secondary impact of loss of business, loss of income for people. That's a secondary impact. Some economists say that that could be made up. Hmm. Certainly, if you're a small business owner who's had no street traffic for days, you're hurting right now.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the ultimate cost is probably, if you combine all the impacts on the economy, it's going to be in the billions of dollars. And those hard-hit communities, those local communities, are already suffering from declining tax revenues because of the weak economy, because of poor real estates and foreclosure and unemployment. And I think that, you know, there is this theory that the economy bounces back from something like this, that, you know, people who have pent-up demand to buy some retail goods. But I think that in the short term, when you're up to your eyeballs in snow, it's really hard to see that.
There's another element, Ron, in that the global warming skeptics are using these snowfalls to say, ha, look at this. How can you say the planet is warming?
That reflects a lack of understanding or a willful lack of understanding of what global climate change is and how it manifests itself. It is probably at least as possible that global effects of climate change are leading to some of these unusual storms, including the ones lashing the West Coast, as it is that this is some sort of disproof of the overall very long-term change in the overall planet temperature.
There's really no
Texas got a foot of snow today.
I don't think that you can really attribute any of these short-term weather events to global warming or climate change. I mean, you're talking about, you know, trends over decades is what really global warming is about. And it's sort of silly, I think, for people to start even debating it in context of, you know, a massive snowstorm hitting the mid-central coast.
All right. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to Port St. Lucie, Florida. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. I'm calling this morning because I am certainly one of those angry, disappointed Americans. I've been unemployed for over a year. And I want to know if you think it's conceivable that any party, politician, Democrat, independent, Republican, would ever stop lining their pockets by big corporations and listening to lobbyists and ever start listening to their constituents and the American population as a whole.
You know, it would seem to call for a change in the whole system to get to that point, Chris.
It would, and I think, unfortunately, with the latest Supreme Court ruling on that's opening up the federal elections to corporate spending, the opposite is going to be true. I think that there's going to be even more leverage in Congress and in local and district elections, statewide elections. The corporations are going to have even more power. It's inevitable.
How can people amass their own power, Ron?
People have to band together. People have to get more information. People have to find ways to make small amounts of money aggregate into an amount of money that then can compete with what larger economic interests can put on the table.
Well, I could counter that, though, in saying, look at the Tea Party movement. That is not a well-funded. They use social networks that did not exist in years prior to this. You used to need money just to send out postcards and get printing done for a poster to say, meet at the town square. Now you could do this for nothing, and you just build your email lists and Facebook pages. So I think you could do it both ways. The there's grassroots, there's netroots, and the underlying thing is, yes, people have to do something. Take back the power, as Howard Dean would say.
Take back the power, Lynn Sweet, the Chicago Sun-Times. Short break and then more of your calls, questions. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. New efforts to stem financial panic in Europe, protests in Iran, and South Africa celebrates the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's prison release. The stories behind the week's top international news. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Thomas Harvey in St. Louis, Missouri. He says, Diane, please don't lament the fact that people are upset with their elected representatives. This is a positive sign that citizens are paying attention to this widespread dysfunction, and maybe that the media is doing a better job covering it, although I'm not convinced. Our elected representatives have simply failed to reflect the interests and needs of average citizens for some time now. Rather, Republicans and Democrats alike represent the interests of the highest corporate bidder in an astonishingly cynical and open manner, and then seem surprised when average citizens take note of their behavior. Ron.
Yes, I do think that people are starting to take note of some of this congressional behavior, and I think that that can only be a good thing if the media are contributing to that, if the news media are contributing to that, and I certainly hope we are. That is the best thing you can say about our performance in recent years. Information is what people need in order to make decisions, and people need to know how these institutions operate. Too much of our notion of these things is, you know, comes from movies and from high school civics. People need to know how these institutions serve themselves.
All right, to Indianapolis. Good morning, Johnny. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. My comment or question is, why is the minority not wanting to let the majority run this country, just like it did when the Republicans were the majority? And my main comment is that President Carter made a statement earlier on about how there was a lot of prejudice or whatever still going on in this country and in our political system. And everybody seems to tiptoe around that issue. That's my comment.
Well, what do you think, Johnny? Is your sense that there is a fair amount of prejudice out there toward President Obama?
Yes, I do, Diane. And the reason why I'm saying I'm a black American, and I've dealt with this, you know, all my life. I turned 60 this year. And I'm sure that President Carter didn't make that statement, being a Southern man himself, just out of the blue. I'm sure he felt that too, and being around the politicians. So it's interesting that the media has not, they've kind of ignored it and said this is a political problem. It seems like they're playing a fraternity game with Obama.
All right. Thanks for your call. Chris Rowland.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. I think that a lot of that sort of, there was a lot, a suggestion last summer, especially when the Tea Party movement was really getting going, that some of it was fueled by prejudicial viewpoints directed toward the president. I think that actually, to me, it seems like that's been disproven to a certain point. I wasn't feeling it from Tennessee, and I wasn't seeing it. I'm not seeing the anger in the posters that were sort of had that overtone to them. And I feel like a lot of the, and I do feel like that the president has been able to lead effectively as a leader in his own right, irregardless of his race. But maybe I have my head in the sand.
But if you recall some of those earlier marches and protests with portraits of the president looking like Adolf Hitler, looking like a clown, looking like the Joker, and then at this Tea Party in Nashville, all of that disappeared, Lynn.
You know, mocking a president is not unique to Obama. That was done for other
Lincoln.
Presidents.
Think about Lincoln.
Right. So our caricature is mocking on that. That's part of the process. I think if you're just saying it was done on a race-based, you know, there have been some things out there, some depictions. I think Mrs. Obama got some rough treatment on an internet thing. But I don't think that the context of whatever is the problems that the Obama White House is having has to be seen necessarily because this is the first African-American president.
What are the problems the Obama White House is having? They seem to have made judgments, misjudgments, new judgments. Who's behind how those judgments are being made?
I think the biggest thing that is a problem for this administration is that what works in a campaign does not necessarily work in the White House. When you are running against an unpopular president in the midst of two unpopular wars with a financial collapse all about you, it makes it easy, in a sense, for the proposition that change and something different is going to make everything better to be believable by people, and people are going to fall in line behind you. Now, let's remember only 53% of the people who voted in November 2008 fell in line. 53% is a good number for a Democratic presidential candidate. It is not an overwhelming final judgment from the American people.
But what are the mistakes that the White House is making in its judgments, Chris?
I think that their sort of moral authority and their moral leadership that they demonstrated during the campaigns evaporated during 2009.
How
when
so?
They became much more pragmatic and they became very willing to get under the hood with Congress deal making. I mean, I think that the special Medicaid deals got really riled up the voters over the health care bill, and on a variety of points they were seen as being much more part of Washington,
okay.
and sort of that outsider, they lost their outsider status.
And what you're saying over and over is they. I'm asking about the president.
Okay, point well made, absolutely. The president, it starts with him. But I think that his team, I think Rahm Emanuel has come under a lot of criticism lately. He is a creature of the House and Congress and is a deal maker, a wheeler and dealer, certainly. I also think that the president coming from the Senate, it's his inclination to figure out how can we make this work? And I think that maybe they lost sight of the mandate that he did have when he came in.
All right, let's go to Leon in Plano, Texas. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Just responding very briefly before I make my main comment to the previous caller, and Diane, you followed up with him about the question, what he thought about race and
sure.
its impact. And I just find, and I am not 60, but I'm, not 30 either, so I've had some experience with this. I just think it's so unfair and blindsided for media types and political types to continue to deny the fact that race has a part in all of our lives. And to say that the Tea Party organizers and participants were not playing the race card or doing some of the very small comments that they make.
Tom Tancredo, for example.
Yes, it has a racist overtone. I would much rather that people just admit that it exists and let the chips fall where they may. And on that note, I think it's so important that media and politicians just go ahead and say, we do not want this government to work properly because it's not in our party's best interest. It is not in our best interest as a politician. For instance, Senator Shelby from Alabama, and I happen to was born and raised in Alabama, to now understand that he's a main person that's raising one hand saying our government doesn't work, and then to have behind his back over 70 nominations that he has held hostage for all of these many months, it's just unforgivable for politicians to continue to do that and for media not to shine a bright light. And I just want to challenge those people on your panel, as well as any other media types that are listening, to help us as Americans to shine a light on the very people that cause our government not to work and to drag us out, pull us out, dig us out of the situation that we're in that's harming our country from our school systems to our national defense system.
Lynn, I think you've made your point very eloquently. I do believe that all of us have a responsibility of making sure we're shining lights where they ought to be shown.
I think that caller makes a really good point. I think that's I do think, though, that from my point of view, I think that the Obama administration, the Obama White House, has proven that you can have a race-blind country to a certain level. I totally agree with the caller that there is racism out there and that it is a factor in American politics. But I think the overriding message of the Obama White House is that he is leading as a Democratic leader, and the policy debates that are happening in Washington now are over ideology. They're not about race. And I think that's important.
Lynn?
I do think that I never want to deny anyone your caller's perspectives, but presidents always have loyal opposition, no matter who they have been. They are oppositions. And as Ron said, he was elected with 53%. That leaves a lot of people out there who are going to, from the get-go, be opposed to him.
But, Lynn, look at the election of George W. Bush. Look at the fact that Republicans got what they wanted to get done with barely, maybe two or three votes, if any, that put George W. into the White House.
There was a rejectionist period right after George W. Bush became president, where a certain number of people were just saying, arguing from the left, that we should not treat him as president because the way in which he had become president, losing the popular vote, winning the disputed vote in Florida, was just illegitimate, and that the man should not be accepted as president. That view did not hold sway, generally speaking. And then, of course, 9/11 happened. He went to 90% approval in the polls, and everything changed. But there was a period of time when people were rejectionist about George W. Bush. We are seeing that again with Obama. We have seen it all through 2009. The difference is, in this case, you have the first African-American president. And so, yes, there's a racial element in the rejectionists among the people who are saying this president is flat out not legitimate. You have the people who don't believe he was born in the United States, and you have some people who simply do not think he qualifies to be president.
Think,
and there is a big racial element.
Right,
in that.
Ron, my point is, those are all the same people. It's not like there's three different groups.
Exactly.
And therefore, I think they still would have had a high degree of not being with the president no matter what.
That may very well be, but there is clearly in their own expression an element of racial rejection.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that they probably would have been against him anyway.
I think that's absolutely right. Okay. And then there are, of course, other issues that matter to them as well.
Let's go now to Chris in Ravenna, Ohio. Hi there. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had called about the focus on the polls, and you've discussed a couple polls already, and I think that's just overblown all the time because the poll from week to week will change, and I think a representative of that is recent polls discussing Scott Brown as some kind of GOP presidential candidate. Scott Brown is unknown in the country, and I think including in Massachusetts he's unknown, and it's just ridiculous, and I think tied to what the previous caller taking the media to task for voter education. I know Mr. Eldine mentioned that there's also voter responsibility. There's no shortage of information out there to learn about government and candidates, and to just blame the media that they're not shining the light. It's also voter responsibility to know different things and not
all
just
right.
The little soundbite.
Thanks a lot for your call. Chris, how well is Scott Brown known in Massachusetts?
I would say Scott Brown has about 100% name recognition in Massachusetts right now, as well as very high name recognition around the country. I mean, he's become a media phenomenon. He's been referenced on Saturday Night Live, you know, and now he's talking about a book deal. He's been interviewed by Barbara Walters and all the national media. And I think his superstar status has something to do with the lack of a clear Republican leader heading into 2012 right now. And I think that's why, you know, you have people sort of speculating that, oh, wow, what a great presidential candidate he could make. I mean, even he says it's silly.
Surely. So did Barack Obama after he was elected.
Well.
Okay, so I've been through this dance before.
Yeah.
How many of the people who know Scott Brown's name know that he's pro-choice?
I think a fair number at this point.
I think in Massachusetts. I think nationally, I don't think
right,
that's known.
Right. I think there are a great many people who would say he achieved a great deal of prominence with that centerfold in Cosmo that certainly elevated him. I keep wondering if a woman had done the same thing, would she have gotten that kind of approval in Massachusetts? Wow.
Yeah, there's a double standard in American politics.
You bet. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida. Angie, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for giving me the chance now.
Sure.
My main question, I agree with the two first callers concerning the racism that is endemic in this country, but what I'm trying to talk about is about the jobs. Okay, there is a bill that is coming out, and they are saying that they're going to attach the incentive for recruiting workers to the employers. Let's say, for example, they buy a machine, they're going to give them money to buy the machine, and they're going to hire, hoping that they're going to hire somebody to operate that machine. I'm against that kind of thinking, because it's still subsidizing a capitalist entity. Whereas I would rather that the government attach that money to a worker. Attaching that money to the worker, you hire somebody, they stay with you 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, you can get an incentive for keeping that worker.
All right. Ron Elving.
This is, to some degree, the price of bipartisanship. If you want to kind of hybridize your approach to creating jobs, you don't go the New Deal route of the 1930s. Instead of just putting people to work with shovels, building things, and moving dirt around, you try to incentivize businesses creating jobs that might theoretically be more permanent and more lucrative and keep them off the government payroll.
Thanks for calling, Angie. I'm certainly glad to hear that Bill Clinton is out of the hospital. The former president finally went to the hospital after feeling this discomfort for several days, had two stents inserted, and now is out of the hospital. Congressman Patrick Kennedy says he won't run for re-election. Really remarkable. No Kennedy in the Congress after five decades.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary to see that Patrick Kennedy is deciding not to run. I think there's several factors that contributed to that. Part of it is a great deal of the death of his father. Patrick Kennedy had an extraordinary attachment to his father. He spoke he eulogized his father, talked about how he craved his father's attention, and his father was such a mentor for him in the Congress. And I think that losing that anchor for Patrick was a bigger blow than many people realize. But and then it's facing some real-life political problems on the ground. Rhode Island has 13% unemployment, so I think the second highest in the country. His job disapproval is around 56% in his district, so he's starting underwater. And he was facing a tough, tough election.
And the deaths of both Congressman John Murtha and the death of Charlie Wilson, Ron.
These are two former Democratic members of Congress, two Democratic members of Congress. Of course, Jack Murtha was still very much the chairman of the Defense Subcommittee, a tremendously powerful man, and Charlie Wilson, mostly famous, of course, because of his work on Afghanistan and the movie about that. Both born in 1932-33, representing kind of the old Democratic North-South Union that is with us very little these days.
Ron Helving, Christopher Rowland, Lynn Sweet. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.